accession number 20610, reel 2.
Jeff Wells, reel 2.
We moved inland. I mean, it could have been a couple of miles. We don't know. But then, with first things first, we had to take the waterproofing off. Well, we landed and went through about 3 foot of water. When the ramp went down at 2:20 in the afternoon, we came out through about 3 foot of water, and we didn't need all the waterproofing we put on, because we didn't know that at the time. So the thing was to take the waterproofing all off, drop the old big funnel at the back, and then we were operational. And that night, by that evening, B Squadron, the Royal Scots Greys, was ashore.
You were in B Squadron?
B Squadron, yes.
Which troop were you in?
I can't remember now. I can't remember. But B Squadron, anyway, B Squadron was ashore that evening, and the Canadians were up there. Anyway, we moved up. I mean, don't ask me where to, because, I mean, you know. But there was a hell of a lot going on. There was a lot going and a lot coming in. And they were expecting a big German counterattack. So the first night they put us into, I suppose it was the perimeter. But everything that was coming ashore was going into this perimeter, because they were expecting this big German counterattack, which never came. Now we know it was the 21st Panzer Division, and Hitler wouldn't give it the okay. But at the time, everybody expected it, and of course it didn't happen. And then after that, come the following morning, it was a very, very hectic night, stuff coming and going. And, you know, moved out in the morning kind of thing, probing, because I assume the thing was that you had to get more room because so much stuff was coming ashore. And you moved off, and of course, I can't remember it from there, but I know it got heavier. The opposition got heavier and heavier as we moved more inland, slowly, slowly, until we got into France, into what they called the Bocage country, which was like the small fields, big hedgerows, ideal for defensive positions. And then the going got really rough. You know, that from a defensive position, it was ideal country, kind of. Eventually, we got to Caen. Caen was a terrible place. I mean, you know, when I say from our point of view, I'm only looking at it from my point of view. The main picture's going on much, much different areas, isn't it? I mean, I'm only in this area. I can only speak for my area. We tried to get into Caen and couldn't. You know, people were coming. We went in, did our stint, came out. Other people went in and everything like that. It was all happening. They couldn't do it. Then we went up to a place called Carpiquet Airfield, which was just to the north of it. And we were doing an OP up there, observation point, on the evening when all the bombers came over and did the bombing run on Caen. And it was a fantastic sight. And then we got pulled back. Anyway, the following day, they tried to get into Caen, but they destroyed Caen, and of course the tanks couldn't get anywhere. It wasn't a tank do anymore. So it was an infantry thing, because so much debris. Anyway, eventually we moved on across the Orne, the River Orne, over like that, to this open country. All right, it was good, bad. It wasn't very good. I tell you something now. You did your training at Bovington. You fired your guns and everything like that. But no one told you what the reaction is to you when the opposition fires back and you get hit. I mean, all right, we got hit several times with mortars and near misses and all like that. But inside that thing, it reverberates like a big drum. And the first time we got hit, us two new boys didn't know what it was all about. But the veterans knew, you know, oh, that's a mortar kind of thing. But for us, we didn't know what it was. I mean, all right, eventually you get used to those kind of things. I mean, you can hear the pitter-patter of small arms fire outside. But, I mean, no one told you what it was like getting hit in all through your training. And, of course, you do get hit. I mean, it's inevitable, isn't it? You get hit with mortars and you get damage and things like that. And then we carried on over, well past Caen, and we got to this place Hill 112. Now, Hill 112, as far as we were concerned, was just another high ground, what we'd done, you know, all the way through from France. And, you know, the different regiments that we were hearing now that were coming ashore wanted to do their thing. Because don't forget, we traipsed all the way across Normandy, hadn't we? So these new boys wanted to come in and get blooded kind of thing, so we were quite content to let them. But this Hill 112 evidently was on a grand scale. I mean, Hill 112 was our little sector, but it was on a grand area kind of thing with lot divisions in it. And the object of this high ground was our B squadron, 19 tanks, was to go up to these woods with a company of infantry and take the woods, which was across about 400 or 500 yards of open ground. So the infantry want armoured support. I mean, we like the infantry when we're close quarters, like they want us when they're out in the open. Anyway, the stonk went over at 6 o'clock in this morning, was the start, across the start line at 6 o'clock in the morning, with the stonk going onto the woods. Anyway, we moved across at 6 o'clock, picked up the infantry, moved out, crossed the open ground, everything, you know, you're belting away with everything you've got. The stonk finished, otherwise it comes down on you. So you're using your own weapons to get the infantry in. I mean, you're only doing, what, 2 mile an hour, because infantry are well loaded, aren't they, with their equipment. We got to these woods, got into the woods. All right, you're sitting around, you're not sitting around, but you're negotiating, settling, you know, oh, the opposition's gone kind of thing, but they hadn't. The other end of the wood was dug in Tigers, 88s, Nebel Waffers, which is the Moaning Minis, and the Jerry Infantry. And they opened up. Now, I mean, they're talking of ranges 300-400 yards. And we just bought it. There was no two ways about it. The armour piercer, the tanks and the 88s were knocking hell. We lost a lot of people. I think 9 out of 19 were knocked out. And the mortars were playing hell with the infantry, because, you know, with a mortar, you go up like that. And amongst the trees, when the mortars come down, they hit the branches and the boughs and everything. And, of course, it's like an airburst, isn't it? It hits them, explodes, and then comes out. Anyway, the infantry took an awful belting. We took an 88. It was just behind me, between the commander, who was standing up at the turret, and I was the gunner in front of him. It came in on the hull just behind me, went across and hit Pete Stevens, because he's sitting on his gunner seat, that loader seat, hit him, and then, of course, the tank went woof, didn't it? It just a fireball. Anyway, I turned round, and the officer went to bail out, the Lieutenant Knowles. He went to bail out, sitting on like the top of the turret, and the little white lights of a spander. You could see the traces of the spander going through him. And he fell off there. Now, you're sitting in a fireball, aren't you? I mean, Dennis Knight, the hull gunner, saying, "Let me out." He must have been stuck. He's shouting and hollering, "Let me out." And of course, you've got to undo your hubs, your lap strap, and you've got your earphones on. You're sitting in a furnace. And the thing is, are you going to sit in the furnace or take your chances out there with the spando? I mean, you're talking in milliseconds, aren't you? And I can remember looking through the top of the turret, through the fire, seeing a lovely blue sky and white clouds, you know, cotton wool puffs of cloud. So you climb out, got outside, and I laid on top of the turret, trying to get my breath, couldn't breathe, I suppose, the smoke and the heat inside. Laid across the top of the turret, and all of a sudden, the little white lights start coming across me again. And I rolled over to roll off the turret, and one went through my arm there. It's all healed up now, went right through my arm. Didn't know at the time.
That's your left arm.
That was my left arm, yeah. And fell on the ground, still trying to get my breath back. And by this time, Mary's a ball of fire, isn't she? Anyway, suddenly a voice from just across the way, "Well, she, over here." It was the driver, Pete Kemble. And when I looked back, he's in one of the German weapon pits taking cover. So we got over to these B both of us got into this weapon pit, and anyway, it was all still happening, mortars and God knows what else coming down. Then it all stopped, there was a lull, and people were running about, and you know, you could see the burning and all like that. Then the 88 stopped, but the mortars kept going. And then you visualise now that it was only the light mortars coming, so the big stuff must have been moving out. Anyway, a lot of infantry mortars come down, and you know, like the air bursts when they're hitting the trees. But the next lull came, and it was chaos, absolute chaos. And the captain, I think he was the second in command, Captain Callender, he started organising people pulling out, you know, to get some people out. And he said he wanted people to hold this right-hand side of the wood to stop any opposition coming up to the front of the wood so they can get their people across the open ground. So pulling out the wood across the open ground to the next lot of cover. But they wanted to stop the people coming this side of the, moving up to the edge, because if they caught their people in the open ground, that's it, isn't it? So anyway, he organised that, and we watched the infantry and all like that carrying their, not carrying their gear, they'd abandoned that, and then carrying their people that could go across the open ground. Now the object was, when everything was cleared, they give us a Veery light, green Veery light, and then we could pull out. And anyway, they gave us a Bren, we found a Bren, and a box of magazines. There was 12 magazines in a box, and various other magazines as well, and we got one of these, a weapon pit. But you see, a weapon pit, what they dug, was facing outwards from the wood, where if we were facing into the wood, so we had the high ground behind us. And anyway, they started pulling out, and every time you saw a shadowy thing, I couldn't fire, because this arm was gone, put a field dressing on it, stuck it in me, zip and all like that. So I was loading for him right on the right-hand side. Pete Campbell was doing, you know, bursts of five or whatever he thought of it. Then we started running short of a bit of ammunition, so Joe Muggins here had to go out and have a prowl round, see if I could find boxes or magazines or something to keep going on, looking anxiously at this blooming, look for the Veery light coming up, but they were still crossing this open ground. Anyway, finally the mortars kept coming, different, and they finally got, you know, to our area kind of thing. Anyway, cut a long story short, we heard this one coming, and we knew it was ours, and it hit behind me on the top of the trench, where like the top of the trench is, and it exploded. But of course, we didn't know anything about it by that time, you know, the concussion had knocked you out. But I had a piece of shrapnel about as big as a 5-penny piece, a bit thicker, and as I was leaning forward like that, it had gone in my left shoulder and carried up inside. If I'd have been sitting up, it most probably killed me, because it had gone in the heart, wouldn't it? Anyway, we were out, finished, you know, we didn't know anything more about anything. Now, I don't know any more about anything apart from, right, now, later on this, I picked the story up from Pete Campbell, because as far as I was concerned, then that was it. But the story comes that Pete Campbell, he came to after, and he wasn't touched. The concussion knocked him out. He got out from the driver's seat, no burns or anything from the tank when it was hit. He carried on firing, and when the explosion came, he hadn't got hit at all. He got badly shaken up and all like that. Now, he went back. He saw me at the bottom of the weapon pit with him, assumed that I'd bought it. Anyway, he wants to get out of it. Anyway, he crossed the open ground on his own, got back to where they were, reported back. Anyway, cut a long story short, they always, on an attack, there's a reserves for a counter-attack. If the attack breaks down, I mean, you could be a forward squadron, you could be like in reserve. And anyway, the reserves came up for a counter-attack. Well, because the counter-attack, by this time, Jerry had just moved out, hadn't he? When the counter-attack came, they moved up into the wood in strength again, and of course, no Jerry there. Well, of course, then all the facilities come up, all the ambulances and the medics and all like that, picking up all the debris kind of thing. Anyway, Pete had come over to where we was with the officers, and evidently our weapon pit was full of spent shells and, you know, everything. Anyway, so the thing was then, he brought them up to where I was laying. Nothing he could do about the tank, that was all gone. And they found me still at the bottom of the weapon pit. Next thing I know, I came to in a half track. Now, this is, you're facing you've got your head tight to the back door. You're facing forward, and you know, everything hurt kind of thing, and you're wondering to yourself in one of your hazy things, memories, who am I with? Because the last thing you knew, what you'd been doing. And anyway, you laying there thinking, now, am I with my own people, or have I been a prisoner of war like with the Germans? Anyway, inside this half track, there's a door that opens out up to the driving section. This door opened, and I could see the daylight, and I could see the driver. He had a British tin hat on, and in a British uniform with the old leather jerkin on, with no sleeve jerkin on. So you knew that you were all right then, and you know, you could go back and, you know, anyway, we arrived at the field hospital at Bayeux eventually, and from there on they sorted me out a bit and then put me on an aeroplane and brought me home to Blackbush Airfield.
Now, can I just go back?
Yes.
And clarify a few things, right, please. Before this incident, mm-hmm, where you got wounded on Hill
112,
had you done much fighting before that?
Oh, yes. I had 3.5 kills.
Can you take me through what happened with those, please?
Right. I can tell you my first one, which is always your best one. We were doing OP again up some woods, across the open ground to another lot of woods over there. And you know, just watching something come up, and out, like, as I'm looking left to right, out from the right hand side was a German firing out towards the left at something. So when we've moved up and got him on the binoculars, it's only a Panther now. Right, excitement, my first German target. But all your good training goes out the window at that time. Panthers face on, I've got a 45 degree angled front plate, which is virtually impenetrable from a distance with the 75s. All it does is ricochet off. This is all part of your training. You forgot that. You've seen your first good target. So the officer gave the orders, AP action, blah, blah, blah. Fire. Oh, I hit it beautifully right on the front. And of course, with the AP shells, you've got a tracer at the back. So you can watch the flight of the shell. And anyway, we watched the flight of the shell. Next thing we know, the shell's going up in the air like that. You can still see the back tracers. Can't, oh dear, oh no, oh yes, it's a Panther, it won't go through, right. He pulls back, but you could see his gun turning to our woods. So we back, officer said, back out of the woods. Next thing we know, there's an 88 zoom through the woods, knocking off branches and boughs and that, and it's gone. So, you know, one of those things. And the next one, next bit was, we're still going back up to the forward again, you know, up to the edge. Next thing, we can't believe it, sometime later, he's come out of the woods. And he's turned sideways on to us, going along the edge of the wood. There must have been a track along that area. Can't believe it. Anyway, the officer, everyone gets excited. 75 again, only this time it goes in the side of him. You've got him this time, because he's got his side onto you. Going from right to left. Anyway, another one for luck under the hull, under the turret. Anyway, of course he brewed. And, you know, that's the first one, and, oh, you feel so happy about it, but it came so unexpectedly. Why he came out the front of this wood, we never know. The second one was a Mark IV.
Where do you think that incident happened with the Panther?
Oh, it was early. Well, in Normandy. It was in Normandy. Because it was the first one. I mean, it was, You know, you've been, I mean, you've fired hundreds and hundreds of rounds, but at targets, they designated targets like houses or villages and all like that. But this was the first thing you'd seen an AFE that you could fire at individually. I mean, they said, well, you know, you've got to put a stonk down here, three rounds over in map reference, so and so. You don't know what you've fired at, do you? Because you just fired at a map reference. But that was the first actual target. And then the next one was a Mark IV. We were on the outskirts of this village, and we could see these two Mark IVs going through the village. But they were going from left to right, but you couldn't get a mark on them because there was like houses, gaps, trees, houses, gaps. So every time you were traversing, there was a house or something in the way. You never got them in the right place. Anyway, they got to the edge of the wood, and there was a bit of open ground, and of course you were traversing and tracking him and all that. Fire, hit him, Mark IV, must have been just behind the turret. Anyway, he brewed. The front one must have kept going. And then the other one was a Nebelwaffe unit. That was the six-barrel mortar with the big half-track that pulls it, and you've got the ammunition trailer there. And either they were going to set up or they were going to, you know, they'd done their thing and was going to pull out. We caught them now from wooded areas again, put one in the half track and that brewed, and then we put the others, two more, into the actual six barrel mortar and the trailer, which must have had the rockets in, that blew up. But always remember, we went back later on in the afternoon, and the half track, on the right hand door, there was someone was sitting there like that, and their arm was still laying out the window like that, but the half track had all brewed, and in the afternoon that arm was still there. So whoever was in there must have brewed with it. And then the half one was later on, these German self-propelled guns. There's like a gun without a turret, but it's got a tank without a turret, but it's got a gun in it. And we come round, you know, in our travels, designated round, I mean, you know, you get sent to these areas. And we came behind this one. There again, it must have been setting up or going on its way. And I put one through the back, 75 through the back of it, started smoking. And another one of our colleagues, this side, the right-hand side, caught him sideways on with another one, and the gun flew right out the hull. So we had half each on that one. Well, I stopped him, and he'd done him, hadn't he? So that was it. But you fired masses and masses at predetermined targets, which, like, you fired at a map reference, or you gave most of your coax, Browning fire, as fire when you're leading infantry, kind of thing. But to actually fire at AFVs, opposition AFVs, armoured fighting vehicles, is something, you know, you like to do, but it doesn't happen. For every round you fire at a designated target, every 10 rounds, you fire one at an AFE. Because you've got to remember that ranges were a lot shorter in Normandy. I mean, 600-700 yards was, because you got the fields and the hedges and all like that. Whereas their 88s could pick us off at, 2,000 yards when they had the open ground, because their muzzle velocity was much greater than ours.
Now, I'd like you to take me through the incident on Hill 112 again, please.
Yes, right.
Could you repeat it?
Yes.
In as much detail as you can remember, step by step, as it happened to you.
Yep.
If you just give me a repeat of it.
Right. We crossed the start line at 6 o'clock on this morning, and under a stonk of 25-pounders and mortars, we moved across the open ground with infantry support. I mean, when you say open ground, you've got a big area of open ground, because you've got 19 tanks and a company and infantry. You'd lead them across, giving all the firepower, and we got into the woods eventually, and everybody's, the infantry are settling in, digging themselves in. Your manoeuvring around, getting put in strategic places and all like that. Then suddenly it all started happening. The Germans were the other end of the wood. You're talking of what, 300, 400, 500 yards, with dug in tanks, 88s and Nebelwaffers. That's the six barrel mortars, what they call them, moaning minis. And they all opened up on us, all like that, and everything was chaos. We lost tanks and everything. Anyway, we got hit eventually. The 88 coming in behind me, in front of the operator, killing the Mush Taylor, the operator, the wireless operator, come gun loader immediately. The tank just went whoosh. And the officer, Lieutenant Knowles, climbed out of the turret to bail out. And as he got out, so I could, I'm looking up at the opening so I could get out, and I could see these little white lights. Well, you knew from experience that these were Spada, whereas our tracers were orange, German tracers were white. And you knew that, and anyway, he was hit, see the tracers going through, he rolled off the side of the tank. Now, you're sitting in a furnace, what are you going to do? I mean, you can hear someone down the front shouting and screaming, that can't get out. You're going to sit in the fire or going to take your chances out the turret? You know, it's the time factor is you've got to make your mind up quickly. So we decide we're going to jump out. I mean, by the time you undo your straps and headphones off, get out. And outside, I laid on top of the turret because I couldn't breathe. And this laying there, I don't know, you know, I mean, I can remember the metal underneath me getting hot. Then that's 3.5 inches of steel, so it shows you what the furnace was like inside. And anyway, these little white lights, I suddenly saw these little white lights going over the top of me. So, you know, I didn't know what, it rolled off. And as I rolled off, I must have put my arm up when one went through. Didn't feel anything, I just fell on the ground and just still trying to breathe. And then I heard this voice shout out over here, like Welshie, and it was our driver, Pete Kemble. And he got to one of these weapon pits, German weapon pits. He was in there, it was quite deep. And I went over there and I suddenly found my arm wouldn't work. And it all happened, there was hell, you know, mortars and light spando and everything. And of course hitting the trees, losing a lot of casualties to the infantry. And it was decided that the heavy stuff stopped. It was infantry stuff that was happening from the Germans. And it just, you know, we had a lull, then it would start up again, and then had a lull and start up again. My watch stopped at 20 to 7 in the morning with a face smashed in. So it shows you we crossed the start line at 6 o'clock in the morning, and my watch has stopped at 20 to 7 with a face smashed in, I suppose, when we got hit. And anyway, they wanted someone to hold this right-hand side so they could get their people out across the open ground, do a bit of covering for them so they could take a few casualties and carry the people and evacuate it, kind of thing, because they'd had enough. And anyway, the officer, Captain Callender, I think he was our number two for the squadron, he said, you know, would you do it? And we said, yes, we'd do it. I don't know why. But we've got brain guns and magazine, boxes of magazines, of 12 magazines in a box. And we started mounting up. When we got the okay, we started doing bursts of 5 rounds, you know, through the woods, just to hope for a deterrent, while they pulled out. And of course, we could see, like, through the wood and across the open ground as well. And we were waiting for a fairy light to come up so that we could, but of course all this light mortar stuff was all going on still, not so heavy, but they knew where we were approximately, and of course they were dropping at different places. I had to go out and do a bit of foraging around because we're running a bit low on ammunition. One hand, it was a bit tricky, but anyway, I did the loading on the right hand side while Pete done the actual firing, because I couldn't use my left arm. And then the mortars came, and we knew this one was ours. It was a lightish infantry mortar. And as we were in a weapon pit, the high side of the weapon pit was facing outwards, which, like it was designated, we were on the inside of it, on the low ground, and it hit the high banking and exploded, and of course that was as far as we were concerned, that didn't know any more about it. Pete Kemble came to, he was knocked out as well. Pete Kemble came to, still wasn't wounded, and he decided that I'd bought